Atheist Nomads, episode 279, Murder in the Arctic.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit, I will be interviewing Lawrence Millman about his recent book, At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic. So his publicist reached out to me about getting him on the show. They sent me out a copy of the book, and it arrived in perfect timing for me to be able to read at the cabin during the summer. And as I was reading, I was like, no, I definitely need to get this guy on the show. This is an amazing story. It's one that it's a piece of history of religion going as horribly wrong as possible that could so easily be completely lost to history. And it's recent. Like, the last survivors are reaching the end of their lives at this point. This is, it's the type of history that it needs to be out there. People need to know about it. One unfortunate thing is Lawrence is anti-technology. So this interview was conducted over the phone, and telephones are not the best for sound quality. I have cleaned it up a little bit and greatly reduced the amount of static, but it's a phone call. There aren't that many frequencies for me to work with. Yeah, and it's been, at this point, probably around 270 episodes since we've done an interview over the phone, and it will be, could very easily be that long before I'm willing to do one again. But it was worth it, and this is an episode that is worth listening to. Enjoy. And we're now joined by Lawrence Millman. He is the author of At the End of the World, A True Story of Murder in the Arctic. It is a fascinating and wonderful read. I highly recommend it. Lawrence, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
I'm delighted to be here, Dustin.
And Lawrence is joining us by phone, so that helps explain why his voice isn't quite as crisp as mine is, but we'll make sure that it's plenty easy to hear.
That's very good. We could say that I prefer phones. I prefer actual conversation face to face. But since we're several thousand miles away, face to face is impossible. And I don't do Skype. I'm a person who believes that most inventions since 1925 should be banned.
Oh, and so now you're on a podcast, which will be listened to by people.
I'm on a podcast. Yes or no? I hired someone for this book. I wrote in this book that only birds should be allowed to tweet. But the publisher said that you have to use, promote it digitally. And I couldn't tweet, not being a bird. So I hired someone to tweet for me. And then on Goodreads, I got all these mean-spirited remarks from good readers. I don't know what else one would call them, who said, well, he's attacking tweets in his book. And there he is tweeting. And in fact, I wasn't tweeting. It was someone, a friend I hired to tweet on my behalf, since I don't do that sort of thing.
All right.
I try to get away from that and that's what initially took me to the Belcher Islands, which I wrote about in the book, which was, still people connected with the natural world, still talking to each other. There were computers there, and as I wrote in the book, I mean, I'm often, when I'm traveling, I want to find out what people are saying, we've accepted your book. Get in touch with us right away, a publisher. So I do want to get emails.
Yeah.
There was a place in the school library where I could go and check emails. But what I really liked was hanging out with people and chatting and hearing old stories, recording the stories, and that's how I initially found out about, you know, the whole issue described in the book where a missionary came to an island where there were only animists, people worshiping virtually everything in the natural world, including shit.
Right.
Everything had a soul, including shit. Anak, it's called. Driftwood had a soul. Birds had a soul. Walrus had souls. And a missionary came and brought a Bible and told everyone, you're absolutely wrong. Only man has a soul. And then he left and left the Bible, and they were a little confused, and that confusion led to the problems I describe in the book, where during a period where there was a bit of hunger in the dead of winter, as there always was, they decided to turn to God. One man declared himself Jesus, another man declared himself God, and anyone who didn't believe in them was Satan, and therefore killed.
Well, this was a, and you describe it very well in the book, as an uncontacted indigenous population that almost immediately gets introduced to religion, then abandoned, and then hit with a natural catastrophe. There's no way that ends well.
Sorry?
There's no way that could end well.
There's no way that it could have ended well, no. There are other events in other parts of the Arctic which are somewhat similar, where, you know, and I mentioned one where a fellow decided that he was God and that would be, they could do anything they want. He was invulnerable, and he was killed. And then there was another incident in another place where a missionary came. This was the Eastern Arctic. And talked about the Holy Land as being the best place in the world. And a man got in his kayak and started paddling there and never was seen again.
Mm.
My guess is he didn't make it to the Holy Land.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all around the world. It was outside missionaries would come and they would show off their superiority. Often it was with, you know, different types of weapons, guns, firearms, etc.
Technology of the day,
clothing, and that would sometimes, in the minds of the native people, if a person can kill a wild animal so readily, then that same person's deity must be extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. Sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Absolutely.
Somebody who's never seen a gun before, a gun is magic.
Yes, and so if the person believes that the missionary says, and we have this guy named God, that's, you know, they will go for that. It's like going for the rifle, going for God. Some of them were not quite, not very nice, though. There was a missionary in the 18th century in Greenland, who took all the shamans and whipped them until it was sort of Naziistic. They said, yes, you're right. We forego our religion. And we'll tell our people that Christianity is the best religion of all.
Mm.
And then there's a famous incident, where a missionary was preaching the Central Canadian Arctic, saying God is the only, the most only worthwhile creature on Earth. And then he said to the Inuit congregation, what's the most worthwhile creature on Earth? And a man said, caribou! the man hit him. The missionary got so angry that he hit him with the Bible. As I said in the book, I think this was, if I had been my own editor, I would have removed this. I said, this just goes to show that the Bible has clout.
Yeah. Man. And so how did you find out about this story?
Well, I found out I'm always on the lookout for obscure stories, and especially ones in the Arctic, incidents where there are a lot of them, and they're undocumented. There's one of a group of Cree killing a Hudson Bay Company trader because the shaman. The trader wouldn't give them any food, and they were starving. Mm-hmm. And the only thing they could do was kill him and get the food. They killed the people who worked for him too, and some of them were Cree. This was in I think beginning of the 20th century. So I'm always on the lookout for stories, both to whet my appetite for stories. I mean, my first book was a celebration of storytelling in the west of Ireland, but also stories that I can then research and write about.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime in the, I guess it would have been the 1990s or so, I heard about this, the incidents in the Belcher Islands, the murders, and the number of people who were accused of being Satan and then disposed of. And I went there to write about it, and it just so happened that I was there at the same time as 9/11.
Which, that's not an easy place to get to.
Well, it isn't. I mean, as I said at the very first sentence in the book, I flew from Boston to Montreal to a town in Nunavik that's half Cree and half Inuit, Great Whale River, and then to the Belcher Islands, which are now known generically as Sanikiluaq. So, I mean, they're probably more difficult places to get to. I mean, it's extremely isolated, but as the crow flies, and I have to throw in a little anecdote, Icelanders picking up English euphemisms, and there was, and sometimes they'll botch them. And I asked one fellow who was pretty knowledgeable in English how far a certain glacier was. He says, "Oh, it's about 30 miles as the cow flies."
Oh, that's awesome.
But as the cow flies from Boston to the Belcher Islands, Boise is quite a bit farther from Boston.
Yeah.
As the cow flies. Than the Belcher Islands. And it's interesting, they were totally ignored by the outside world. They're in the middle of Hudson Bay. They're not far north. There are, I'm thinking there are lots of places, the British Isles, that are farther north than mm-hmm. the Belcher Islands, latitude 56 degrees north.
Now, are they in Nunavut, or are they in one of the provinces?
They're in Nunavut.
Okay.
Even though they're closer to Nunavik, which is the Quebec Inuit autonomous region.
Okay.
They're much closer, but they are in Nunavut, which is the, as of 1999, the newest Canadian territory.
Okay.
But in the early 20th century, they had not been visited at all by outsiders, because, most outsiders who were heading to the Arctic were looking to find the Northwest Passage or head to the North Pole.
Or wanted gold.
Sorry?
Or wanted gold.
Or wanted gold, yes, into the Western Arctic. And the Belcher Islands were in the middle of the Hudson Bay is notoriously bad weather, unpredictable weather. Winds are horrific, it doesn't have the cold spells, extreme cold spells as the high Arctic, but it has winds and difficulty, and since there are many islands, getting to those islands, yes, you might be able to get to them, but you might never be able to leave, stuck there by the winds.
Oh, wow.
And the first documented outsider to show up in the Belcher Islands was Robert Flaherty, who is known as a filmmaker. He was then an iron ore prospector, and he he got his material for Nanuk of the North. He was forced to overwinter there because it wasn't because of the wind. It was because his boat crashed on the rocks. And another reason people had stayed away over the centuries was that the islands are surrounded by rocks. They're very low-lying. And the first thing you know, your boat has crashed into the rocks. Anyway, that's what happened with him. He was looking for iron ore, and he overwintered. And during the course of his filmmaking life, he celebrated primitive people. First with Nanuk of the North, but Nanuk of the North is really based on material that he collected and experienced in the Belcher Islands. But then in the west of Ireland, Man of Erin. And then in Samoa, he made a film called Moana. And again, in each one of these films, he documents a natural way of life, sometimes fictionalizing what he saw, as he did in Nanuk of the North. But he was the first visitor.
Okay.
And then there were a few after him, a few more, but nobody stuck around. The Hudson Bay Company guy came in the 30s, but he wasn't trying to convert anybody. And then a missionary came in the mid-30s and told people what was in the Bible, but he simplified it to the fact that heaven is a good place, hell isn't a good place. Jesus is a good guy, God is maybe even better, but Satan, he's the worst. I don't know. It went a little bit farther than that, but a couple people had mentioned to me when I was there in 2001, there were still some very elderly people who would have remembered. They were alive at the time, but they didn't remember. They couldn't say anything about the missionary, but they said something about the confusion of the adult Inuit. Well, here was a guy who somehow had gotten himself stuck on a pair of cross sticks.
Mm-hmm.
That's Jesus, of course. That was hard to believe, the elders thought. There aren't any there are drift logs, but they're very useful, and people don't end up getting pinned to them the way Jesus got pinned to his. There was probably a good bit of dubiousness about what the missionary said, but there were enough believers who thought, well, the fellow is from the outside. He must be better than we are.
That's a horrible assumption.
Yes, it is, but it's not an uncommon one. I mean, missionaries, somebody should really write a book. There are still missionaries in different parts of the world today, and someone should write a book just lashing them. As they should be lashed. I mentioned to you earlier, before this interview began, in Nunavik, there are any number of strictly Pentecostal communities. And it's bizarre. What happened was the Pentecostal church ended up they wanted to get converts, and the best way to convert Native people in North America is to get Asians, because Asians actually look a bit like Native people. So Hong Kong missionaries went to some of these Inuit communities and spoke the gospel and essentially said, everything in your past was the work of the devil.
Uh-huh.
You need to be saved, and then you will be free. Everything in the past was actually all their old traditions.
Uh-huh.
Songs, dances, stories, beliefs.
Their entire culture.
Entire culture would have been banished. And I've seen this again and again. I was in a Cree community. It's not just the Inuit, it's Cree community in North Central. It's in the boreal forest of Quebec. Probably shouldn't mention any names. And this old man was showing me a scapula divination. You take the scapula bone of the animal you're hunting and read the cracks and char mark to determine where the animal is or the herd of that animal is. And this was, of course, part of the satanic past. And the village heard about this, and he was raked over the coals. I heard from another party that what they said is, now that white guy is going to go and tell the world that we're worshipers of the devil because of what you did.
Wow. Yeah, the method of evangelism that I was taught in college, and unfortunately...
Were you taught, did you grow up in an evangelical
Adventist
manner?
I was raised Adventist, got a degree in theology, did a year in the seminary, and actually quit mid-evangelistic series in Mexico. So I tried the whole convince people that they're evil sinners, that you have the answers, and that you can save them. It didn't even work on me, but it's a highly effective method. And it sounds like what they've been doing up in the North is not even necessarily convincing people they're sinners, but that their culture is bad.
Well, and as a result, they're sinners. I mean, one of the things that ends up being introduced into the stew is the fact a lot of these communities, there's drug addiction and alcoholism. And the missionaries, the recent missionaries, will talk about that, and you know this is a way of getting rid of. They associate the alcoholism, drug addiction, with a dead past. You know, there's no dead. There's the past is dead, and you're not living in the present. But once you convert, you will be living in the present. And one of the things about this Cree community I mentioned to you, where the fellow performed the scapular divination, there was a bit of alcoholism and drug abuse. There isn't now. And my feeling is it was better, healthier in the days when there was alcoholism and drug abuse. Now it's squeaky clean that the people don't have their culture anymore. I mean, they had dances and songs and scapular divinations, but now those are regarded as evil. And, you know, as time passes, they will be utterly forgotten.
Oh, man.
And here's another thing. I got a grant to go to probably the major petroglyph site in the Arctic, in Hudson Strait. And there are carved these faces on the rock, hundreds of them. And there's lines dripping out of the bottom. I think they're in Mexico. They're similar, and these are talking in tongues. You know, the people, the heads are talking in tongues. It's a remarkable sight. But local Pentecostals have been going there and doing two things. I mean, they've been etching crosses over the faces or trying to destroy the faces because they call them the devil's map.
Oh, no.
Major archaeological site destroyed by Pentecostal mania.
Oh, that is horrible. I've seen petroglyphs, and they are absolutely incredible. The fact that anybody would destroy them is horrible.
Yeah, a lot in the West. Southwest, absolutely incredible.
Yeah,
and these are on an island. They can't be. It's hard to protect them. It's in a remote place. You can't have a caretaker there, and finding a caretaker who's not a Pentecostal could be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
In the schools in one community, I won't mention the name unless you insist. Evolution isn't even taught, and there was a woman. There was a guy who beat up his wife. And then said God told him to do it, and he wasn't convicted or arraigned or anything. After all, God told him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The police, the Mounties were in fact Pentecostals themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, we have quite a few Pentecostals in Idaho, and
do you?
Yep. And one particular group is called the Followers of Christ, and thanks to Richard Nixon, they have free reign to let their children die needlessly.
Huh. What do you mean, thanks to Richard Nixon?
Nixon was the one who pushed all the states into putting in shield laws to protect faith healers.
Oh, yes.
He had a Christian scientist in his administration who pressured him to do that. And Idaho has not repealed that law. So as much as the county sheriff might want to arrest these parents for neglect, the sheriff can't do anything. Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. By the way, I can't remember now, and I may be wrong. Ted Kaczynski, who philosophically is one of my heroes. And I say philosophically, I was trying to get him a copy of this book. Maybe he could blurb it. Was he in Idaho when he was captured, or was he in Montana?
Oh, let me check.
For some reason, I thought it was Idaho, but I may be absolutely wrong here. My knowledge of the 48 states is far more, I'm more ignorant than I am about the Arctic.
He was in Montana.
Okay.
Idaho was the Ruby Ridge shooting.
Oh, yes, that inspired that's right. Him. Yeah, right, exactly.
And now we have some of the Bundys here.
You have some of the Bundys coming over from Oregon.
Well, from the Bundy family's from Nevada. Some of them live
that's right.
Here.
That's right.
And they went over to Oregon from Boise to take the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge and destroy a bunch of Native American artifacts.
Mm-hmm. And they've now migrated to Idaho. From Nevada?
Some of them. Some
of them. Yes, they would have gotten a different, if I had been a judge, and our judges now, it's hard to think of American politics without thinking of jokes, but if I'd been judge, they would not have gotten off so freely.
Oh, if I'd been in charge, it would have been declared an insurrection, and the military would have been sent in.
And it was an insurrection.
Uh-huh, yeah. They were an armed revolt against the U.S. government.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, what was happening was that this was an area, this was a pristine area, and I mean, the real problem, and one of the problems of America is ownership. You know, once you own something, you destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
That's an American, somehow the fulfillment of the American dream.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, there's a tiny little reservation in Burns, and then 30 miles away is where the Wildlife Refuge headquarters is, and just outside of the headquarters building is some of their most sacred burial grounds.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that part of the reservation?
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's, I don't know quite what to say. I mean, and then I can find analogies in the Arctic. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous.
And so, okay, so with this, the story you were researching there in the Belcher Islands, once these guys decided they were, you know, one was God and one was Jesus, how did they convince everybody to go along?
Well, you know, it's interesting how they did this. This happened at a time when, you know, there was very little food around. And, you know, in a difficult situation like that, I suppose people, and also they convinced people that they were God and Jesus because they said, when, you know, if you believe in us and you believe in heaven, then you won't have to worry about food anymore. Starvation will be a thing of the past if you become a good Christian. And they were forceful people. And God, you know, it's very interesting. Peter Sala. He was the best hunter and the tallest man. He was, in some way, appropriately God.
Mm.
And he, what he would have said in the past, people would have agreed with because they would have respected him. And so it was that he became God, and many of them agreed with him. But there were people... I had informants. A lot of people didn't want to talk to me about this story because they were embarrassed. They thought it made them look primitive and, you know, not pre-contact or just, you know, marginally contacted, but primitive. But one of my main informants who said I couldn't use her name, but she would happily talk to me was an elderly woman. And she talked about the first incident there was a 13-year-old girl named Sarah who wasn't a believer. And Peter Sala said, I'm God on the inside. I may look like Peter Sala on the outside. I'm God on the inside. And Sarah, 13, said, you're Peter Sala on the outside and Peter Sala on the inside. Mm. And there were a series of angry remarks, and somebody held a Primus stove to her face and said, she's Satan. And then she was attacked. And she didn't repent, and someone whacked her with the barrel of a rifle and took her out, and she was whacked and killed by another 13-year-old girl, 14, maybe 14, named Akinik. And the old woman who was telling me this, we had to divide into 2 days because Sarah had been her best friend. And she remembered this very well. And it was 60 years later, but she still remembered it, and she broke up. And her grandson, who was there helping out occasionally with the language, I do speak some Inuktitut, said, enough for today.
Yeah.
And I came back, and we finished the story. And, you know, this was just the beginning, perhaps the most bizarre. And again, it's you know, there are all these ingredients, things, you know, white man's religion, period of starvation, people who were community leaders sort of in charge, put these all together, and it explains it. But the number of people weren't followers, and they ended up suffering the consequences. The ultimate event was Peter Sala's sister, Mina, deciding that she started... She had a dog wick. Inuit dog wick is extraordinary. This isn't a visual event, so I can't show you how to flick it, but if you flick it in the right way, you can take out the eye of a dog or the ear, take off the ear of a dog.
Oh, wow.
Imagine what people would feel like if someone with a dog whip was herding them out onto the ice, as Mina was.
Uh-huh.
And she started deciding that they have to go on the ice to meet their savior. He is kayaking down from the sky. This was not this sort of combination of the two cultures, kayaking and Jesus coming, sort of made sense to people. Kayaking vertically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I doubt that I would have been a believer, but she forced them, mostly older people and children, out onto the ice and whacking them with this whip. And then she said, and we must greet our Savior naked and force them to remove all their clothes. It was about 25 below.
Oh.
She kept her clothes on.
Oh.
And adults who didn't come out kept, suddenly maybe they saw the light, but they started going out onto the ice and grabbing the children and hugging them to give them warmth and bring them back to shore. But when it was over, there were 6 people who had frozen to death.
That doesn't take long to do at those temperatures.
It doesn't take long to do at those at all. Mina wasn't one of them. What happened with her and the others, they were exiled forever from the Belcher Islands. And as somebody told me, one of the native people said, when you have the islands in your blood and when your people have evolved, grandparents and great-grandparents and so on, to be removed forever is worse than being executed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were all sent off. You know, in my northern travels, there's certain incidents that just stick and are going to forever stick in my mind. And this is one of them. Shortly after the exiles arrived in Moose Factory, Ontario, Cree Village, and they were just put up in tents in the Mountie compound there, there was a Cree Episcopal school, Episcopalian ministers. It wasn't a resident school. This fellow who was about 10 was heading over to school. He saw the Inuit from the Belchers, and he saw this woman who had killed, this girl who had killed Sarah, who was only about 14 or 15, Tommy, he didn't know the story, walked up to her and started speaking Cree, and she started speaking Inuktitut, and they tried to communicate and burst into riotous laughter. And he arrived at school half an hour late. The teacher minister was furious and started beating him with not a dog whip, but with a cane. And then flash come forward 60 years to when I talked to this fellow. 70 years, I talked to him in 2010, I think it was.
Okay.
He looked at me, and there was a welling of tears in his eyes. And he said, and now, almost 70 years later, I still have no feeling in this hand.
Mm. Wow.
Yes, I was very, I was chatting with him, and he told me that story. I was very moved.
That's quite the beating.
Yes, it is. I did collect stories about what they were doing, how they were, some of them ended up staying in Moose Factory, and Akinik ended up as a maid for a cleaning woman, and she was in various northern Inuit communities. And it's very interesting. I mean, it's psychologically interesting. You know, she went mad cleaning things.
Mm-hmm.
She learned how to use a vacuum cleaner. Was she trying to erase her past? She still was religious and went to Anglican church, the major church in those parts. But, you know, she would descend on houses and without permission of the people, start cleaning those houses.
Oh, wow. That's neurotic.
That's, yeah, more than neurotic, probably psychotic. But, I mean, she was officially the cleaning woman for the nuns, the school teacher at the school, and so on. And she did that. But it wasn't Akinik. I lie. I'm getting confused because I was talking about Akinik. It was Mina, the woman who ushered the people out on the ice, who went into the bizarre cleaning role. I haven't read my book for a while. You know, she had a little tent in the village, and armed. She was armed with all this cleaning stuff. And was she trying to erase from her memory what she had done to the people on ice? I don't know.
It makes sense.
It does make sense. It does indeed make sense. And she was sort of, a bit crazed. She went to church three times a day, lived in a tent, and the inside of the tent was filled with brooms and cleaning apparatuses.
Hmm. Wow. Wow, that is crazy.
An old person in the village whom I met said that whenever we would look out the window and see her approaching, we locked all the doors and windows.
Yeah, most people would be happy for somebody to come and clean their house, but that sounds a bit extreme.
Well, you would think so, but what if it had been just done the previous day or two? Here she is back again. And she would wash clothes. She would take clothes and wash the clothes without actually getting the permission. She wouldn't remove clothes while people were wearing the clothes, but she would wash them. And again, this could be some attempt at some kind of catharsis.
Hmm.
But yeah, you would think that people would be happy. It was a free cleaning, so to speak.
Yeah.
It was also an invasion. I mean, imagine you're sitting down to dinner and somebody burst in and starts going over the floor with a vacuum cleaner and while you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'd care for that.
Now, one thing that's interesting with these stories is they're old enough that the last eyewitnesses have probably died by now.
By now, 77 years, maybe a few kids are still alive. I was there in 2001, and it was only elders who remembered the stories. It was maybe others had heard about them, but they didn't want to talk about them because it made them seem less advanced than they actually were at the time. So, but now I would say, yes, you're right. I mean, maybe a few kids, but for the most part, nobody is around who actually remembers firsthand what was going on.
So you kept the story from dying.
I kept the story from dying. And I have to admit, one of the things I've devoted myself to in my career, I collected a lot of Inuit stories in Greenland, Labrador, and Eastern Canadian Arctic, and put them in another of my books called A Kayak Full of Ghosts. And I was devoted to this because I wanted to keep the stories from disappearing off the planet. And some of the other lore I've collected, same thing, I put them in books. And I was watching something. I lived in the west of Ireland, and I celebrated oral culture and storytelling in the book called Arlach Will Not Be There Again. And a lot of what I was recording from people had disappeared except from the mouths of the very old. And when they left, no one was recording it. Those stories would vanish forever.
Wow. So how did you get started collecting these stories? That's an interesting career to get into.
Well, it was interesting. I was a prisoner of war at an academic institution. Basically, I got a doctorate in English literature. And I got so tired of the classroom and in academic writing and reading, et cetera, and not much oral stuff. I went to live in Ireland, where people live by spoken word rather than the written word.
Hmm.
And got involved with, you know, some old people who were storytellers, and I got a contract to write this book, which is about story. It's about storytelling, but the context of story. I mean, it isn't a collection of stories. It's about the context. It's what storytelling means, and a lot of what's in my the book I've been talking to you about, At the End of the World, is in my first book written 30 some years earlier. For instance, the first television arrived on an island called Inishbofin, put in a bar, and it was referred to as the monster because it interfered with people's conversing with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were other incidents as well where I noted in another place, someone, old person, said, "You see this television in our house?" This old person, he didn't get the television. In the old days, that place was exactly where the Shanaki, the storyteller, sat. And now the television is the storyteller.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's sort of how I got involved, that being in Ireland. And I like being in Ireland because I like places that are sort of, the weather isn't altogether reliable. And there's a lot of natural world as well as human beings.
Okay.
More natural world than human beings, I should say.
Yeah. And it's hard to find a place better for that than the Arctic.
Hard to find a place better than the Arctic. I've now been to the Arctic and subarctic probably 40 times, and I don't go at least once or twice a year. I go for my health as much as for anything else.
Yeah.
I was just in a remote place in Alaska, and this will be of interest to you. Given the name of this show. So this is a remote place, Lake Clark.
Okay.
A lot of subsistence activities, hunting and fishing. People want to be sort of alone and traditional. It's a big lake. There's a gentleman who is buying property and turning it into religious retreats.
Oh, no.
Franklin Graham.
Oh.
You know who he is?
Yep.
Billy Graham's son.
Oh, man.
And clear-cutting forests that have never been clear-cut in this one tiny village on the lake. There are only two villages on the lake. He turned the one store into a retreat for where people hung out. And now there's no store. He bought the store and de-storified.
Hmm.
And he's convincing people, yes, Jesus is the future, the only hope, etc. The people I were staying with on the lake, you know, you could only go by boat or air, but Franklin Graham is flying people in. Some of them are sport fishermen. A lot of them are war vets who are traumatized, and he's teaching them that the way to get over their trauma is to embrace Jesus. Mm. I don't know if it's successful or not, but what happened not so long ago was that there was a small plane ended up crashing into the lake and two young girls died. And my friends went to the funeral, and the father got up on the podium. He had been a convert, and he smiled happily and said, "They've gone to a better place."
Oh, man.
That courtesy, I suppose, of Franklin Graham. Tell the truth, I hadn't heard of him until this. I knew about the father, recently deceased, but I did not know anything about Franklin. He's very wealthy.
Oh, yeah. He's made a lot of money with his Samaritan's Purse charity.
That's exactly what it was, and there was a Samaritan's Purse burger stand. The one place where I could get food in this small village. Wasn't bad burgers, by the way. Samaritans can make good burgers. But, yeah, he's made a lot of money that way. A lot of these people were Southerners, very conservative, very religious. And I coined a phrase that I'm hoping will go viral in that neck of the woods, referring to his followers as Graham crackers.
Nice.
Yeah, I was appalled by that. I mean, this is a pristine lake, and then there are these places where they're building large lodges that are sort of fishing and religious simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And the locals who've been there for, like my friends, forever, are not too pleased by this. Franklin Graham is going to some of the native people who are very poor and offering them like 10 times what their land is worth so he can buy it. And how could they refuse?
Yeah. And then once they take it, their way of life is done.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Man. That's just terrible.
It's just terrible. And I may be writing something about this someday. It was so depressing to me that I didn't go overboard in trying to get more information about it. The stories I got were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
About especially this, I just can't believe this story where the father of two recently deceased young girls gets up on the podium and smiles at the congregation and says they've gone to a better place.
Yeah.
Truly bizarre.
So I'm actually tweaking with the order on the interview, which I normally don't do. It's normally just how it flows is how I release it. And for this episode, I am actually taking most of the beginning and putting it at the end. So I took out from about 2 minutes into the actual interview itself to around 20 minutes. And that's going to be the next part that you're going to hear. And the reason was it's about his views on technology in the modern world and kind of his critique of it. And I think it's an interesting perspective, one that we don't hear very often. And I do think it's worth having in the show, but I didn't necessarily want to be leading off with it because I didn't want people to be hitting the skip button in rage before actually getting to the meat of the episode, the meat of the interview, the topic that I had him on to talk about, these murders in the Arctic. But yeah, this is an interesting perspective to hear on a podcast. You will be pleased to know that I was reading your book at my wife's family's cabin. We were up in the mountains enjoying a lot of fresh air and nature. And when it was too cold in the evening, I sat and enjoyed actual words on paper.
I'm delighted to hear that. Where were you in what area in Colorado?
That was in Island Park, Idaho.
Oh, not been there.
Yeah,
that's right. You're in Boise.
I'm in Boise, yep. And Island Park is just outside of Yellowstone.
Okay. Not been there. You know, the thing is, I would be terrified of Yellowstone, not for fear of being attacked by a bear, Quite the contrary, I enjoy it. I've had so many run-ins with bears, none of them, as you can imagine, fatal.
Mm-hmm.
But tourists. And in my book, you may recall there, I'm there with a bunch of the Inuit watching 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
They just cannot fathom this. And one of the Inuit turns to me and said, who's responsible for this? And I said, terrorists. And he looked at me and he said, well, I'm so glad we don't have any tourists here. I see them, the sort of creeping multitudes. I used to live in Iceland, a great place, a place where people had their own culture and their own language, but its accessibility both to Europe and the U.S. now has meant that it is a tourist mecca. And in the old days, there were dirt roads, and you might have guessed that I prefer dirt roads mm-hmm. to superhighways. And now there are superhighways, and I could hitchhike, but there would be so few cars, I would have to wait long lengths of time. But now it's hard to cross the road because of the constant traffic.
Mm.
Anyway, that's a little bit of a sidetrack from why I've not been to Yellowstone.
Yeah. And now what you'll find mostly is that in the summertime, it'll be very large Mormon families and ridiculous amounts of people. And if you go off season, which is a much better time to be there, it will be numerous busloads of Chinese tourists.
I have to say, and I don't want to seem prejudiced, that I have yet to find anywhere in the world that doesn't have numerous busloads of Chinese tourists. In East Greenland, remote, I mean, there weren't busloads because there are no roads and no buses, but they certainly fly in great quantities. And I have a somewhat disheveled look about me, so do Greenlanders. And a Chinese woman came up to me, camera. I mean, it's sometimes hard to tell if a person is Chinese because they always have cameras. They're always shooting,
yep.
You know, their eyes, their face are covered by cameras. Sorry for the prejudicial remark. Anyway, the woman asked. Said to me, Greenlander, looking at my disheveled self. And I said, no, but it was too late. She had already taken my pictures, and I dare say that my photo will be now passed around in some part of China. Here's an example, they will say in their lingo, of a iconic Greenlander.
That is awesome.
That will be me. And then also I've seen in East Greenland batches of Chinese tourists just taking photos of tiny airports, but not of the tininess. Okay, there'll be a sign that says exit, restroom, next flight. And that's what they'll be photographing.
Okay, I've taken pictures of signs before.
Yeah, and it really has a lot to do with my book, because my book is in part... an attack on screens.
Mm-hmm.
And screens are, I say, the new religion. We worship them. We can't get away from them. We bow down to them metaphorically. And to me, they're no less pernicious than the old religion hosted by the world's most unpleasant fictional character, a guy named God.
All right. There's... I can see a few similarities, also some vast differences.
There are a couple of distances. Yes, there are differences, a few. But time will tell, and there may be more and more. I mean, there may be, I don't think there are quite yet churches devoted to the worship of the internet, they don't have to be, because people can worship it in the privacy of their own homes.
Well, I would, I like to say that the digital revolution is bigger and more important than the industrial revolution was, in the way, or at least as much. It's the biggest change since the industrial revolution. And
I could not agree with you more. It's altered thinking habits. lifestyles, brain. I mean, mm-hmm. there's, you know, people who depend upon the internet, and this is documented. I'm not, you know, again, ranting, lose some of their memory because they don't need it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're practical creatures. I mean, if you don't need a memory because you can always get something off the internet, there's no need. You don't have it. It's an evolutionary thing.
Yeah, I can only remember like 5 phone numbers now. I used to know a whole lot.
I hardly remember that many, but it's partially because my brain tells me that I don't need to remember phone numbers. But because I'm a mycologist, among other things, I remember, I have in my head the names of about, 1,000 mushrooms.
Hmm.
Those, to me, are more memorable than, those names are more memorable than the phone numbers.
All right.
I have, you know, it's also interesting, and I talk about this in the book too, there's a big difference between writing a letter and sending an email and receiving that letter and receiving an email. And I don't want to use any religious terminology with respect to my atheistical self, but I have managed to convert quite a few people to letter writing. And I get handwritten letters. I spend far more time, I think, answering handwritten letters to people than I do sending emails.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I said in the book, too, that, you know, let's say you've got a friend named Mushpan Mike living in the wilds of Alaska, and he writes you a letter telling you he's fallen in love with a female moose. And his letter is all crazed and zigzaggy because he's mad and passionate in his state of love. Let's say he also sends, or he alternatively sends it as an email. And what I say is, it's not love anymore. Because it's just sort of cozy, easy, every syllable being the same. There's nothing that in the letter writing that suggests passion.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I can appreciate that. There is something different about a handwritten note. I recently read some handwritten note on the podcast. It is so much harder to read.
Well, that is one of the drawbacks. And my own handwriting, if I sent you a handwritten note, you know, what I like to think is, even when it's incomprehensible, it's at least artistic.
Yeah.
Because it moves in very zigzaggy directions.
Now, of course, we do have the trend happening of more and more communication being audio again, and even video.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like, my parents live 500 miles away, and they get to see my daughter on Skype. And they wouldn't get to see her so often if it wasn't for that.
But are they really seeing her? They're seeing an image of her, a square image of her.
It's not the same, but it's better than just... She's 10 months old, so it's better than just talking to her on the phone since she doesn't talk.
Oh, I see, yes. You know, my argument with this is basically, moderation is okay, but it's hard for people to get moderate when they're using these devices. They're like monkeys with shiny toys, and they really go overboard. So, yes, occasionally a Skype, but you know, a couple times daily. And now, I was telling you before about, you know, I restrict the amount of time I spend with my computer to about an hour a day, because I don't want to end up being stuck in a pretzel position or having a morphology that's zigzaggy the way I think our species will end up owing to the sit-down nature of their lives. And, you know, the thing is, I was looking at where was a photo of New York 1905, people on the street. They were all very slender. Now, obesity is the rule of the game, and I know that there are all these groups that argue that, you know, fat women are good, fat men are good, fatties are great. I'm not so certain that that's true health-wise, but in any event, the one of the reasons for this is the sit-down nature of American life in front of a TV or in front of a computer or riding in a two-ton wheelchair known as an automobile.
Yeah, yeah, that's...
And I guess
that's
definitely a big factor. Yeah, I'm not saying anything new here.
Yeah. Yeah, in high school, I worked in a lumber mill, and there wasn't anybody really obese there.
Mm-hmm. No, because you know they were working, they were outside, they were being physical.
Oh, we were all trapped indoors, but constant movement, constant work.
Yeah, constant movement.
Uh-huh.
A thing of the past, I fear.
Right, because machines can do it cheaper and faster with a lower error rate.
And easier, yes, they can do it, but one has to think about what one loses with facility. I mean, the passage, the experience of being in a place and, you know, failing and then trying to succeed and then failing. I mean, as a writer, it's much more interesting for me to write about my screwing up, whatever it is I screwed up, than to write about a successful trip. Where everything, the planes arrived on time and everyone arrived on time and I stayed in an upscale lodge. I would rather walk somewhere than ride, even though it's easier to ride. Because guess of all the things I can see along the way, not just mushrooms. And I live here in Cambridge, Mass. And if it's within 5 miles, I will walk.
Hmm.
Just the other day, I found a mushroom I had never seen before in my life anywhere because I was walking. Of course, if I had been driving sealed up in a hermetically sealed off automotive vehicle, I would not have seen it at all.
Yeah. No, that's and definitely one amazing thing with walking or riding a bike. You can see so much more.
You can, yeah. It's very true. And I love bike riding, too. By the way, but I would love to go back to the days of horse and buggy or what the droshkies, that's the old Russian word for a horse-drawn cart. You know, you don't need cement. The manure gets into the soil and helps it. You know, you might not get, you know, I don't think you'd get stuck in gridlock droshky traffic. But, I mean, you'd be there with another organism, a horse, and you'd have a great affection for that. I know people have great affections for their cars and sometimes give them names. But I have no affection for cars. You know, when I was with my ex and the car didn't work, I would call it all sorts of names that were very unpleasant, but they weren't personalized names. The old nag, that's what you could call a horse that takes the wrong turn, but when the car wouldn't start, it would be stuck in ice or be something like that. I think how much easier this would be not to have a car because I'm mired in this bloody thing, or mired in traffic. That was the worst, gridlock traffic. You don't have to worry about that in your neck of the woods.
It's starting to get there.
Really?
Yeah.
And this is going to become worse and worse in our automotively inspired country.
Well, we have the problem in Boise of it's the fastest growing city in the country. And
it is.
It's still hell-bent on, with the exception of the city of Boise's government, everybody else is hell-bent on this myth that Boise is a small town. It's going to be a metropolitan area of 1 million people here within 10 years.
You jest.
No.
What is the attractant? I mean, is it Californians? Every time there's an earthquake or a natural disaster, the state vomits out in all directions some of its residents. And in Montana, you know, they were talking about the some years ago, the Californification of Montana. But what's causing the rise in Boise's population?
So there's a number of factors. One is the exodus of young people from the rural areas in Idaho. They're all moving into Boise. The young people in Boise are leaving Boise young people in Salt Lake are moving to Boise. Californians are moving up. So you get Mormons who don't want to live in too Mormon of an area, making it a more Mormon area, as well as ex-Mormons who want a culture they can at least appreciate, not feel quite so foreign. And on top of it, the tech industry is growing here. It's kind of becoming one of the new feeder
areas. That's a big explanation.
And we still have a substantial agricultural industry. One of the biggest employers in the area is still Simplot. They just redid the Idaho, complete redesign of the Idaho History Museum. And you get to see all the big names in the area. And it is Simplot and Amalgamated Sugar, and it's the big agriculture businesses.
Very interesting. Yeah. I had not known that. I'm one of those people that you refer to as, I think, naive about Boise, thinking of it as a university town, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a Boise State University in Boise, and then there's Northwest Nazarene University in Nampa right next door, and then the next town over is the College of Idaho, which used to be Albertson College because it was started by the Albertson family of the grocery store chain.
Oh, very interesting indeed.
But one of the things with, you know, it's easy to try to romanticize the old days with, you know, horse-drawn buggies. But New York City in the 1880s had horrific gridlock with horses. And
yes, I knew that. I knew you were going to bring that up.
20 feet of manure they had to be clearing out every week.
Mm-hmm. This is true, which brings up, you know, another issue which we won't need to talk about. But one reason I'm attracted to the Arctic is there's more nature than people.
Mm-hmm.
And overpopulation, I mean, I think one can regard overpopulation as the biggest problem in the world today, and that most other problems are related to it, including the excessive use of technology, because if, you know, too many people, how do you solve issues? You've got to solve them very quickly and get on to the next person and solve the issue.
My job is tech in a medical setting, so yeah, I have to resolve issues quickly to make sure people don't die.
Yeah. And, you know, it's very interesting. There's a paradox. I know a number of tech people. Almost all of them have a broad view of technology and appreciate nature and are not as smitten by technology as just the ordinary person who gets up in the morning. I mean, a guy who's got a third grade education can rise out of bed, drag his bulbous stomach over to his computer, and he can reach more readers than Shakespeare ever has in the last 400 years combined.
Yeah.
And that says something. I don't know if it says something about literacy or it just says something about the universal language of computers.
Well, Lawrence, we are out of time.
Yes. Well, I'm delighted to be talking to you, Dustin.
Yes, it's been a real pleasure.
Keep me posted as to when this will appear on the internet.
Yeah, I definitely will do that. And
I've enjoyed talking to you enormously.
Yes. And okay, so At the End of the World is available on Amazon and all of the brick and mortar bookstores, right?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Freely available. And it is, in print, and I recommend that perhaps you try to order it via a bookstore rather than Amazon, because Amazon is the enemy of publishers. it is taking the place of publishers, in fact. And if you could go to a bookstore, it's also taking place in bookstores. They're going under, going belly up. I'm sure half a dozen, even during this interview, have gone belly up. Go to a local bookstore, and if it's not in stock, order it. And not only will you be doing me a favor, but you will be doing the bookstore a favor, and you will be doing Sanity a favor, and you will be casting a vote for, what should we call it, anti-corporation, whatever we want to call it.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess all that remains is for me to remind our listeners that not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.